This is Continuous Coverage.
Continuous Coverage.
Continuous Coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill from the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hidden Killers Podcast.
Welcome back to our Continuous Coverage in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill. We're up to segment number 2 of 4 in the trial on the 27th of April, 2023. Let's take a listen.
All right, we're going back on the record. KCR 22-21-1624, State versus Lori Noreen Vallow. Mr. Thomas, you can continue with your cross-examination at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe we left off talking about your education and where you were working at the or going to a master's program at the National Intelligence University. Did you do anything between 2001 and when you started the when did you start the National Intelligence University?
That would be August of 2022.
Okay, so last year.
Yes, sir.
Any education between 2001 when you graduated from Texas A&M and 2022?
Other than continuing education with the lab, no other formal education.
Okay. And when you got out of college in 2001, was the FBI your first job?
No, sir, it was not.
Okay. What was your first job out of college?
My first job was at the Texas A&M University in the biochemistry physics department. But unfortunately, a few months after that, I was reactivated into the United States Marine Corps after 9/11.
Okay. Wow. Thank you for your service. What did you do? How long were you in the Marine Corps? After 2001, when you got out, you were reactivated. Let's talk a little bit about the reactivation. How long were you in the Marine Corps?
Active service, about 1 year, and in a reserve, I think, for another year.
Okay. And so then what did you do after that?
After I completed my service, I went back to Texas A&M, continued working at the university, I believe a year. Then I actually got a job working with the Drug Enforcement Administration in Miami, Florida, as a forensic chemist.
Okay. And that was probably in 2004, 2005?
I worked there for 3 years, so I believe it from 2004 to 2007.
Okay. And then what did you do when you got out of the DEA?
I took a job working for the Army at the Testing Proving Ground in Dugway, which is located in Utah. I worked there as a field chemist doing chem warfare chemistry.
Okay. And that's in Tooele, Utah?
Yes, sir. It is.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I worked there for a little over 2 years.
Okay. And so that would have been 2009-ish when you left that?
Yes, sir.
And then where'd you go?
That's when I was offered an opportunity to join the FBI.
Okay. And you've been at the FBI ever since?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so you indicated on direct exam that you did training for about 2.5 years. Is that right?
That is correct.
And was that training specifically on the tool mark portion of your FBI work?
Yes, it was. Part of it is with the firearms aspect, but you can think of a firearm as really nothing more than a collection of tools in order for it to operate. So, yes, the entire time I was working on tool marks.
Okay. And you said you were directly supervised by a tool mark examiner. Is that right?
Yes, sir. There, I guess to expand on that, there was actually a training coordinator who was responsible for the entire program, but you're actually every trainee has a mentor, and they just kind of guide you through the process.
Okay. And your mentor was with you the whole 2.5 years?
He was, during the entire 2.5 years, yes, he was training me.
Okay. And so how many other times have you worked since 2009, 2010 area, the last probably 14, 15 years, on bones with knives or machetes or those the types of implements that were used in this particular case?
Those are infrequent examinations. They don't occur that often.
Okay. And over the course of your career with the FBI, how many times do you think? Less than 10?
I would say maybe about 5 or 6 times.
Five or six times. Okay. And does the FBI have a, I guess what I'm thinking is that when somebody brings something in, you have a vast array of tools you can choose from to try to match up what caused an injury. Is that correct, or am I kind of thinking in fantasy land?
No, you're correct. There are different reference collections. So if this case involved firearms, there's a large reference collection that I could use as tools. We have a large tool room that has different reference tools that are available to us. You're correct.
Okay. And so in this particular case, when the bones came in and you were given the task of identifying the tool marks, did you go into that vast collection of or different collections of tools to see what may have caused these particular traumas or injuries or marks?
That is correct. I did. The thing about doing the tool marks, it's not just the tools that you're using, but the surface or media you're testing on. So mm-hmm. That is correct.
Okay. And so when you're testing on this type of media, you have to know some background, like how many foot-pounds of pressure it would take to cause this particular injury, right?
No, you don't have to actually go that far. The efforts are using the tools available, the reference tools, and different media sources to try to replicate those marks. So in situations like that, I'm just taking the tool and I'm trying to replicate whatever type of tool mark that was created using those reference tools as well as the media which I'm testing it on.
And so what type of reference tools did you use on this particular case?
I used a collection of different types of bladed knives, hatchets, a couple of machetes. It was just a lot of different tools that I used.
And so that's where you came to the conclusion that this was either made by a machete, a hatchet, or a knife?
I didn't. In the report, I specified they were consistent with. So the injuries, the tool marks that I saw, the types of tool marks were consistent with those types of tools. I do want to specify, too, that aside from generating a report and testifying the report, it's also used as a lead source for law enforcement. So it allows them to actually kind of read over those tools and then in their investigation try to locate any tools that are similar to those, which could be submitted or resubmitted to the laboratory for testing.
And so in this particular case, there was testimony that some tools were seized by the FBI, by your agency, and then you indicated on direct examination that none of those tools were actually used in trying to figure out what caused these particular injuries. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm going to object. Counsel is testifying to facts not in evidence and asking for information that I think there's not an adequate foundation for this witness to answer.
I'll overrule that objection at this time.
So there were tools that were seized. If I could just repeat the question, is that okay?
Yes.
So there were tools that were seized by the FBI and your agency, and you testified that no tools came to you from any other agency or your own agency to test with this particular these particular bones. Is that right?
There were no tools submitted. So the only evidence that was submitted to me were the bones. No tools were actually submitted to the laboratory.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of any tools.
Okay. And did you ask anybody if there were any tools that were seized?
No, I did not.
Okay. Is there any reason why you didn't do that?
No. Once the report is issued, that case is kind of closed out. And for the laboratory, at least for my unit, you're just moving on to the next examinations and generating those reports as well. So I did not follow up on this case, other than the fact that once that report was issued to the field, then...
Who issued the report?
Oh, I issued the report.
Okay. But before you issued the report, you didn't go back and say, hey, in order for me to complete my report, I would like to see some sort of, did you gather anything? You didn't ask any of those questions.
No, I did not.
Okay. And you said there's no particular reason why you didn't.
I wasn't aware that there was any tools in the case. I assumed if there were tools in the case, they would have been submitted to the laboratory.
Okay. So it was somewhere down the chain that may have screwed up and not submitting them to you.
Yeah, there were no tools submitted to me. I don't know how that process works.
Okay. And do you think that would have been more helpful to find out maybe if these tools were the ones that made these marks?
It would have been helpful to have tools to analyze in the case. That is correct.
Okay. When these specific specimens came in, and I call them specimens because my question is, was there any flesh before you got the bones on these specimens?
There were not. It was pretty much just the bone material. There was some dried tissue, but not much.
Okay. So did you, in your analysis, did you assume that whatever cut through to the bone would have gone through skin, tissue, muscle, those kinds of things prior to hitting the bone?
I was aware of that fact.
And is that the assumption you made in making your report?
No. My analyst was just focused on those tool marks on the bone. Essentially, all I'm doing is looking at those tool marks and trying to determine those class characteristics.
Okay. As far as the class characteristics, you're basically saying what type of implement was used to make these particular marks?
Yes, that's correct. The tool marks that were made, or the tool marks that were imparted onto the bones, through my training experience, I was trying to generate those class characteristics and then going through the examination process. I was not able to make any direct determination other than just tools that are consistent with producing those types of marks.
You indicated that there was possibly some serrated type of a tool, right?
That is correct.
Did you come to a conclusion that it was a serrated tool or just that it was consistent with a serrated tool?
That the tool marks had consistent marks, that the tool marks had marks that were consistent with being produced from a serrated tool.
Okay. And with that particular injury with the serrated tool, how far apart were these serrated tool marks?
I did not measure those.
Okay.
Essentially, when they were produced, they were adjacent to each other.
Okay. Is there any reason why you didn't measure the width of the teeth on that serrated?
During analysis, it wasn't essential. Had there been a tool that came with the case or was submitted with the bones, then yes, those measurements would have been appropriate.
Okay. One of the things that you indicated in defining the class characteristics, you kind of went through the different things, and then you said something about microscopic characteristics. You recall that?
Yes. The okay. Types of tools, yes.
Okay. And so did you put these bones under the microscope and look at the tool marks under the microscope?
I was unable to locate any of those individual characteristics, so I was never actually able to move on to the microscopy part of the examination.
Okay. So is it true that you don't know what caused these marks? You just know that it was something.
That's correct. All I know is the marks are generated by some tool that's consistent in making those marks. But no, I don't know exactly what tool was used.
Okay. And you weren't able to differentiate whether it was a man or a woman who may have done this?
Oh, no, I would. That's not something I could determine from examining the tool marks.
Okay. In examining the tool marks, were you able to identify how much force would have had to have been applied?
No, I did not. That's not something that could be determined from the tool marks.
Okay. Is there someone in your department that you know of at the FBI who could determine how much force would have been applied and that may have been something to pass this particular piece of evidence on to?
That's not an examination that the laboratory conducts, at least not in the firearms and tool marks unit.
Okay. Are you part of the, let me put it this way. Is there any interdepartmental discussions as to where to go from when you're done with yours to what we should do next type thing?
That's left essentially up to the case agent. So the case agent for the case, essentially the laboratory, the forensic examinations, that's just kind of one part of the investigative package.
Okay. So, and I don't mean to overgeneralize the FBI or your particular lab, but I'm, and tell me if this analogy works for you, I'm kind of making the comparison of me walking into the Home Depot and saying, hey, I need a nut that is, 3/4 of an inch in diameter, and I go ask the guy, and he gives me that. And your lab is that specialized where you are basically, you ask me to do something, and I do it, and I don't give you any other further information. Is that where we're at?
The laboratory is fortunate that there are a lot of disciplines that exist within the laboratory that are rare in state and local laboratories. I believe the laboratory, the FBI laboratory, makes a lot of effort to try to answer as many questions as possible, but you are limited to the evidence itself. Essentially, for myself and the examination of those tool marks, the examination cannot really go much beyond the tool marks themselves. So I'm not thinking about or analyzing the amount of tissue between the tool and the surface of the bone. I'm just focused on the tool marks on the bone.
The difference between the stabbing tool marks and the chopping tool marks, can you, because that's basically what we have here. We don't have anything else other than stabbing and chopping, correct?
That is correct.
All right. And it looks like you identified one stabbing tool mark and the rest were chopping type tool marks, right?
I was able to determine that those tool marks were consistent with because identification is a whole different a source identification basically is when I'm identifying a tool back to a tool mark. No identifications were made in this case. So, yes, from the examinations, two of which occurred from a stabbing, and the majority of the rest occurred from a chopping action.
Okay. So the chopping and the stabbing, I'm a little confused with which is which. So the stabbing would be something with a finite width and length, or at least width. Is that right?
Yes, so the energy that's being transferred from the tool to the surface is focused on a very narrow area, where a chopping type action still force is being applied, but that force is being focused over a long axis of the cutting blade. Does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah, I think so. And so would these injuries be consistent with someone who was sophisticated or unsophisticated? Do you know?
Oh, I couldn't answer that question.
Okay. I don't have any further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Redirect, Ms. Rawlings.
Mr. Halapaska, two things. I think you were asked whether, I think if the phrase was something caused these marks, but you've identified certain class characteristics. Is that right?
Yes, I made determinations on the type of class characteristics that could cause those tool marks, those injuries.
And what were those again?
You're talking about the tools or the types
tools.
So for the stabbing type action would be a bladed tool like a knife. The chopping type actions, and these are again consistent with a bladed type tool such as a cleaver, a machete, and a hatchet.
Okay.
And then some of those class characteristics did have serrated or appeared to have serrated teeth on them.
All right. And we talked about stabbing, chopping, and I think previously you talked about compression actions. Are those also, are those related to chopping actions?
They could be. It's just that I wasn't able to garner any class characteristics. So in the situations when I used the term compressive force, I knew that some kind of force was applied to those bones, but there were no class characteristics for me to kind of source populate it, like when I talked about the screwdrivers, the flathead, and the Phillips. I wasn't able to differentiate with those two tool marks or injured areas that had those compressive forces applied to them.
And based on the tool marks in this case on the bones, if you had been provided specific tools, would you have been able to utilize them in identifying the marks?
I would have been able to make test marks with them. But as you recall, throughout the examination process, I wasn't able to locate any individual characteristics. So I would have been able just to make the same general characteristics. Basically, just I wouldn't be able to identify the tools back to the bones because the bones didn't have those individual characteristics that would have allowed me to in order to make those source determinations.
I don't have anything further, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rawlings. That will conclude the testimony of this witness then. Thank you for your appearance. Is the witness excused or released from any subpoena?
Yes, he is, Your Honor.
Any objection?
No objection.
The defense? Thank you, Mr. Thomas. So, Mr. Halapaska, you may be excused, and the bailiff will assist you out. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the state can call its next witness.
Your Honor, the state will be calling Mr. Sincerbo.
All right. Before we begin with examination, then, I'll just briefly ask the witness, who's now under oath, Mr. Sincerbo, have you in any way reviewed any of this trial testimony, either by reading it, listening to it online, or in any of the locations where this trial has been broadcast since it started?
No, I have not.
Okay. Thank you for your response to that. In your questioning, please make verbal responses to any question asked to you so we can keep a clear record and try to avoid speaking at the same time as any attorney that is questioning you, and just speak directly into that microphone as well. And with that in mind, Ms. Smith, you can commence with your direct examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you introduce yourself to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury and spell your last name?
My name is David Sincerbo, and my last name is spelled S-I-N-C-E-R-B-E-A-U-X.
Okay. Sir, how are you employed?
Currently, I'm retired from the Idaho State Police. I actually am umpiring softball for Northern Idaho.
Okay. So before you retired, and you worked at the lab, what did you do at the Idaho State Lab?
My primary job was to analyze controlled substances, but I also did fire debris analysis, and I've been doing that for 26 years.
What was your educational background before starting at the lab?
I have a bachelor's of science degree in chemistry from Cal State Northridge, and I was an analytical chemist since 1985.
Okay. So what is an analytical chemist?
Basically, I test either evidence or other substances for particular chemical substances.
So in your background as an analytical chemist, were you always at the Idaho State Lab?
No, I was not.
Where were you before that?
I worked in Southern California as an environmental chemist for two different corporations.
Okay. And in that capacity, what did you do?
Primarily for that is I was, since it was environmental, I did anything from pesticides, but our main focus was underground storage tanks. So I did a lot of gasoline and diesel, basically stuff from gas stations.
And in your capacity as an analytical chemist throughout your career, have you ever had a chance in your experience to examine fire debris?
Yes.
What have you done with that?
For the last 10 years or so at Idaho State Police, we tested things for suspected arson cases.
Okay. And you also talked about doing a chemical analysis. What do you mean by chemical analysis?
We use a variety of instruments and or wet chemistry techniques to analyze evidence for the presence of ignitable liquids.
Okay. Throughout the years, do you have any idea of how many items or pieces of evidence that you have examined for the presence of chemicals?
For both fire debris and?
Yes.
Tens of thousands.
Okay. Of that group, have you ever had a chance to look for the presence of gasoline?
Yes.
Okay. What process do you use to look for gasoline in items?
What we do is once the evidence gets into our possession, I'll walk you through the whole thing. The first thing we do is we check to make sure, or when I receive it, I check to make sure that it's in a sealed condition. If for some reason it is not, we have the option of either returning it to the agency, or if it's a minor thing, such as, you know, let's say there was a missing piece of evidence tape or something like that, we can put that on and we'll just note that in our notes. Once we do that, we bring it back to our lab bench area. If it's typically it's going to come in a friction lid can, which is basically a paint can. We will open that up, make a quick observation of what it looks like, what's on the inside. From there, we'll put in a small strip of activated charcoal. We basically suspend that in the can. We reseal it, we put it back in an oven. We cook it for about 4 hours at 70 degrees centigrade, which is about 160 degrees Fahrenheit. Once it's done baking, we basically take it out, let it cool to room temperature. We will then extract the carbon strip that is in there. We put that carbon strip in a little glass vial, add some solvent to it. That solvent we then inject onto an instrument called a GCMS, and that will tell us what compounds may or may not be present.
So in Idaho State Lab, lab number 2020-2233, did you examine item 17 submitted by the Rexburg Police Department as part of your duties at the Idaho State Lab?
Yes, I did.
And do you recall what item 17 was?
It was a pint-sized can that contained some decomposing flesh and other debris.
Okay. What analysis did you do of item 17 from the Rexburg Police Department of the decomposing flesh and debris?
Like I just previously stated, I put in a charcoal strip, sealed up the can, baked it, and then extracted the strip, and then ran it on a GCMS.
Okay. And that item 17 was from the Rexburg Police Department with the names associated of Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow, and J.J. Vallow, amongst others?
That is correct.
Okay. And so when you examined item 17 and you did your chemical analysis, what results, if any, did you get of that decomposing flesh?
In that can contained gasoline.
And the item, when you say in that can, was that the flesh in the can?
Since the gasoline that we actually analyze, when we heat it up, it basically, if there's any volatile liquids, they will become a vapor. They will then attach to it. Whether it was in or on the flesh or in the other debris that was in that can, I have no idea from whence the source was. It's just in that can contained gasoline.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Smith. Mr. Thomas, cross-examination.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Sensorbaugh.
Good morning.
you indicate that you are an analytical chemist.
That is correct.
And you used to work for the ISP, and now you're an empire?
Yes.
So your specific task was to see if there was gasoline present in the debris that was sent to you?
Basically for any ignitable liquids, gasoline or other.
Okay. And other being something like propane or kerosene or something like that?
Not so much propane since that'd be a gas, but
yeah,
it's going to be, you know, paint thinners or basically up to diesel.
Okay. And you said you put this into, it came in a paint can. Was it a 1 gallon paint can, or do you recall? I guess I should ask, do you recall?
It was a pint.
One pint.
Yes.
And there are 4 pints in a gallon. Is that right? I don't know.
Actually, no, there's 4 quarts in a gallon.
Okay.
And I think there's 2 pints per a quart.
So it's a very small can.
Yeah, about that big around.
Okay.
So, yeah, not very big.
So, okay. So I'm thinking about when I go to the store to buy paint, I know the gallon size, what it looks like, and then the next size down is either the pint or the quart.
That would be the quart. And then there's the smaller one, which is
kind of like a test.
For the layman, if you were having a small one that you wanted to see if the paint was going to look good on your wall, you'd buy that one and see if it looked right.
And that's the one that came to you. That's the size that came to you.
Correct.
Great. Okay. That makes sense. And then you popped off the top of it. And how full of that particular can was this substance in there?
I don't recall exactly when we give advice to the people who are actually taking the samples for it. We want at least, as much as kind of we can get, but we want to have some head space, so we want it about 3/4 full. And if I vaguely remember, it's probably about 1/2 to 3/4 full.
Okay. And the prosecutor, Ms. Smith, indicated that it was flesh. I believe she said flesh. Did she say flesh that was in there?
Do you recall?
I believe so. I think that's what I put down in my notes, was that and other debris.
Okay. And I guess the other debris is what I'm looking for. How much of the other debris was it as opposed to the flesh type thing?
I don't recall exactly.
Okay.
Probably 50-50.
Okay.
I guess.
So 50% dirt and other stuff, and then 50% of the flesh.
Correct.
All right. And then you put an activated charcoal strip?
Correct.
And is that, I guess I know what activated charcoal is. It's just like charcoal, right? But what does the strip look like? What are we looking at?
To be exact, it's 100 square millimeters. That's basically a small little strip. It's about a half inch, three-quarter inch long and about a quarter inch wide.
Okay.
And it's basically, it's a polymer that has the activated charcoal embedded in it.
Okay. And is it kind of flexible like a piece of paper, or is it more hard like a piece of wood?
More flexible.
More flexible, okay.
Sort of like construction paper.
And do you like suspend it somehow with a piece of string or something? I don't know how you do that.
What we actually use is Christmas tree ornaments, hangers, and we basically just stick it through and then bend it and put it in through the lip of the can and then put the lid on, and it basically suspends on one end of the hanger.
Okay. But you don't want it to touch the actual substance that's in there, right?
You try not to.
Try not to touch it. Okay. And then you said you put it in a GCMS. For the layperson, that is a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. And you're just putting a little charcoal strip in there, right?
We actually put the solvent. We take the charcoal strip, put that in a glass vial, add some solvent, which it happens to be solvent called carbon disulfide. We will put that. Okay. And then we put the charcoal strip in there, and then we add a solvent, which is carbon disulfide.
All right. And so and that solvent is how much of that solvent goes into the GCMS?
Into the actual GCMS, we inject 1 microliter.
Okay. And so if that were in a syringe, how much of a how much? What would it look like to a layperson, like somebody on the jury? What would that look like?
It's not a lot. It's if you had a drop of water, it's probably about a tenth of a drop of water.
Okay. And so, does that go on a slide, like a glass slide?
No. I'll explain really briefly what a GCMS and how it works.
Sure.
The GCMS, the gas chromatograph, is a fancy temperature-controlled oven that has a column that's on the inside. What happens is when we inject that small amount of liquid, it hits an injection port that is at about 280 degrees centigrade, which basically flashes it and makes it a vapor. That vapor is then swept along through that column, and then it will separate out organic molecules primarily by molecular weight, meaning small, lightweight ones come through faster, heavier ones take more time. Once it has done that separation, it then goes into the mass spectrometer, which is a detector, which takes that organic molecule, hits it with a bunch of electrons, it basically fragments it, and we collect the fragmentation, we get a pattern. We compare that pattern to known standards, and that's how we make our identification. In the case of gasoline, we are looking for a wide variety of compounds that are indicative of gasoline, and if they're present, we compare that to our known set of standards, and that's how we make our identification.
Okay. And isn't it true that you can actually tell which particular companies are producing this particular type of gas?
No.
You can't.
Some people in our field will claim they can do that. I do not believe that ISP or realistically anyone else has that ability. We don't perform that at ISP. Just to me, I think it's unreliable.
Okay. So you weren't able to identify any specific detergents that might be associated with Chevron or any type of compounds that Shell says that we have this particular compound in our gasoline.
And for ISP, no, we do not.
Okay. And so the bottom line is you found
gasoline in that debris and or flesh, right?
That is correct.
Okay. You weren't able to quantify how much gasoline based on an extrapolation formula or something like that?
No, it had all of the components of gasoline.
Okay. So it could have been anywhere between just a little bit to a whole bunch.
Correct. I mean, okay. It's basically enough for me to detect that there was gasoline present.
All right. Thank you. No further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
And there's no redirect, Your Honor. May this witness be excused?
Any objection to excusing the witness?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for your appearance. Mr. Sincerbo, you can be excused, and thank you for your testimony. The bailiff will assist you out of the courtroom.
That's the latest in segment number two. Segment three is on the way next. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuous coverage in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell.
This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hidden Killers Podcast.